Hello, this is Henry.
Hey, Henry, this is Alex Jones. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, Alex, I can hear you fine. Thanks for calling. I'm not really too sure what you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I'm gonna get to that. But first, your toasters are unplugged, right?
Yes, Alex, I got the encoded message from your carrier pigeon. I unplugged all of my toasters, so don't worry.
All right, good. You never know who's listening. So the reason why I reached out to you, Henry, is because you're the only person I can trust. I'm about to break a big story, and the globalists are going to be doing everything they can to stop me from breaking it. I got the documents to prove that Lena Dunham right now is out in America trying to gather photon crystals. And what these photon crystals are is they form every single time someone doesn't rate and review your podcast or give it a 5-star rating. These photon crystals, they contain fragments of the soul of Joseph Stalin.
Alex, photon crystals?
Yeah, photon crystals. I have all the documents right here. And once she gets enough of them, she's going to open an interdimensional portal and summon the remains of Joseph Stalin to create a new Soviet Union in America.
Alex, have you been drinking?
No, Henry, I haven't been drinking. Soros is behind this too. You need to get people to rate and review your podcast and give it a 5-star rating and review, especially if you're on iTunes.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it. I'm a bit confused, but thanks for the call.
It's happening. The globalists are about to make their move. They're going to make a...
Welcome to brewhistory.com.
What's going on? It's Henry and Danny with Bro History, and this is the first actual intro where we introduced ourselves in a pretty long time. We've been testing out a new technique where, well, actually, it's not really a technique. It's just an easier way to record things where we just actually record for about 20 minutes straight, and then we kind of pick the part in the recording where it actually starts making sense and where we start getting closer to the topic, because believe it or not, it's kind of hard to do the whole intro thing and going into a topic and staying at a concise story. And you know, the way that we like to do things here, we like to be a little silly and we like to go from topic to topic and never really stay on one thing. It's kind of strange for a history podcast. So if you're expecting a straight up history podcast about, you know, fucking the ancient Samaritans, well, you were mistaken. You were in the wrong place.
I believe you meant to say Sumerians.
Okay.
So in addition to not being good at staying on topic, we're also really shitty at pronouncing names and things like that. And we've been called out a whole lot for just absolutely butchering words and phrases. But, you know, we just want to thank everybody out there for, you know, your continued support and rating and reviewing and following us on Facebook. I think, you know, it definitely really helps us out a lot. And, you know, like Henry said, we're trying out a bunch of new things. You know, let us know what you like and what you don't like so we can continue making the podcast better for y'all.
Yes. So I guess we should just get started. We should start talking about the elephant in the room. And of course, we're actually recording this on election day. So by the time this is released, you know, that the midterms will be all but over, I guess, except for that that jungle primary in Missouri where they're going to have a runoff election in November 20th. But
That's right.
I don't want to go too into that because we're not really a political podcast. We're more of a history podcast. But I just want to give my two cents in. No matter what happens, well, first of all, my prediction I think is going to happen. Like, I predicted that the Republicans were going to keep the Senate, the Democrats were going to keep the House. Both, it was going to be very close throughout the entire midterms, and both parties are going to declare victory. That was my prediction, that it was going to be close. Both parties are going to end up declaring victory.
I couldn't agree with you more, man. That's exactly my prediction too. It's a little far-fetched to think that there's going to be a giant blue wave. We've already seen a bunch of stuff come in already to suggest that it's been, you know, kind of just like a small wave, you know, but definitely going to pick up the House, I think, by a couple of seats, and Senate's probably staying with the Republicans firmly. So
at this time, that we are recording, the Republicans have already made one gain in the Senate.
Right.
So they're up three. Democrats, I don't have the numbers.
Democrats have
right
pulled
now.
Up. Yeah, I actually do. I'm watching CNN right now. they're conveniently have a scroll on 24/7, even during their commercials. So I think it's eight. They literally just switched the graphic. It's eight pickups on the House side for Democrats. So it's pretty much going along with what we predicted. So anyway, we're going to be here for a long time. Polls close in California at like 11 p.m. Eastern time. So and they're notorious about like taking their time to count their votes. And then we also have Alaska and Hawaii, which I'm pretty sure everyone knows exactly how those are going to go. But it won't be until super late tonight, if not, early tomorrow morning that we'll find out the actual results. So,
and I was looking at different candidates. I haven't really looked that far into the different Republican candidates or the different Democratic candidates for that matter. But while looking at some of the Republican, I was interested in some of the candidates. So I was just looking at their policy page and, you know, what their stances are on certain issues. And I swear to God, every single one of them had the exact same page. It was like it was copy and pasted. Like,
and a lot of times
same
they are.
Pages.
They are.
So it's like the exact same policy on, you know, tax regulation, the exact same policy
on immigration,
on healthcare, the exact same policy on Israel, the exact same policy on Iran.
You know why?
It's 'cause
that's
the
same
policy on Syria. And that's more the stuff I follow, but it's like, you know, every single Republican, they tote the generic line of, all right, we support Israel. For the most part, we support regime change. I mean, not as much as they did, you know, 5 years ago, but it's boring to me. It's just like, I don't really want to vote for, I don't want to go to a poll and vote for that. So I almost remove myself from the political process completely, because I do have gripes with both parties. They're different gripes for different reasons, and you know, this is not really meant to be a political show where I isolate one side or another. The reason why I'm telling you I hate everyone is because I want everyone. I don't want to exclude anyone. I don't want to pick on Democrats, and I don't
equal
want to pick
opportunity,
on Republicans.
Equal opportunity roasting here at Bro History, right? That's our mantra.
We make fun of everyone.
Right.
We make fun of everyone, and we have everyone on the show as well. So we will have there's a big free speech policy on this. Except maybe if you're fucking really batshit crazy.
Yeah, if you're an asshole, you know.
if you're an asshole and you start saying, if you like come on the show and start fucking saying just absolutely disgusting stuff, then most likely I won't want to deal with you or just have a conversation with you. But if you're like, no, not an asshole and you have a very controversial opinion, then yes, you're more than welcome to be on the show. Like even if you're like someone like Richard Spencer or somebody, like I'm fine talking to someone like Richard Spencer. I just don't want someone who's disrespectful and who comes on a show to
spew
just bullshit.
Yeah.
And fucking like the spew things that are toxic, intentionally. Not to say I think a lot of like, you know, what Richard Spencer believes in is pretty toxic. But you know, my values couldn't be more diametrically opposed to his.
Right.
However, I would talk to somebody like that if they were civil. So that's kind of like where the line is. It's free range. It's the Wild West. Just don't say naughty words. I don't know.
No, you can say as many naughty words as you like.
Yeah, you can say. There was like the podcast that I did with Judah the other day, or like it was a couple of weeks ago actually. The last 20 minutes of it is just talking about the most disgusting stories ever. it went from like a very serious podcast talking about the Yom Kippur War into talking about the most disgusting fucking shit. And, I felt sorry for somebody who was like, really looking for a history podcast. It's like, oh, I finally found a podcast on the Yom Kippur War. I can finally finish my thesis. The final sources.
If you're trying to get your final sources on your thesis or the Yom Kippur War from a podcast called Bro History, I think maybe you don't deserve to be in grad school. Well, I'd like to blow your mind today with a topic that we came up with a little bit earlier on a very, very special weapon in the history of weapons, and it's the AK-47.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because we were talking about different topics for weapons and stuff like that, just to keep all the guys who like guns happy. Because, you know, there's a lot of people who like guns who it's listen to meat. The show.
It's red meat.
It's red meat, guns and tanks and planes. I mean, I like that stuff too.
Yeah, me too.
But to be completely honest, something I thought of is that I think people nowadays know more about guns and just war equipment, or military equipment rather, from video games.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's where I got my start. I mean, I'd like to consider myself the resident expert on military tech based on my experience with Call of Duty and Battlefield and the different places like that. So, yeah.
And it's so weird. It's so funny to me that these kids who are probably like 13 years old, they probably are an expert on like the latest, not the latest military technology, but you know, the military technology that's been introduced on the field of combat over the past like three decades or so.
I mean, some of these game developers are really good at not only just give, like, I personally like playing, you know, these war games just because they'll often have a really exciting campaign. And when they do follow an actual historical, you know, tone, it's fun because it's like, you know, I enjoy history. Obviously, I'm on Bro History right now. But I also like first person shooters. It's like fun to run around and, like, you know, snipe somebody in the face and then like teabag them, you know, like that's fun, you know. So it brings two, you know, guilty pleasures of mine together. And these game developers are getting so good at things like, you know, obviously like bullet physics, right? So one of my more favorite first person shooters is Battlefield, and there's like bullet drop, right? So it takes into account the curvature of the earth. So when you're shooting somebody from really far away, it's like it matters where you're shooting. You have to aim a little high if they're super far away, you know, and the optics work really well. And you know, you get to learn a lot about the specifications of these weapons, the ammunition that they use, you know, their rate of fire, the different attachments that you can put onto them, and I also want to talk about this one, but even just the sound and general feeling of these weapons. Now I've actually had an opportunity to fire the AK-47 among a few other rifles there, and I got to say it's an impressive weapon, and I think it's an impressive weapon not just because it looks cool and it's a strong assault rifle, but because I think it's got such an interesting history, and I'm really excited to talk to you about it.
What makes it so interesting to me, and I don't know shit about guns, I'll be completely honest to everyone who's listening. I'm the one who's like super Second Amendment, and I don't know that much about firearms to begin with. however, that what makes this AK-47 interesting to me is that the gun was manufactured, I mean, almost immediately after World War II. It's been in the Soviet arsenal since 1949, I think.
Yep.
And
so,
those guns have been on the combat field basically forever. Like I posted a video on the Facebook page of this guy who found this AK buried underground for 18 years, and he pulls it out with an oil, just with some oil.
Some motor oil.
He's like rubbing oil, motor oil. They're able to fire it again. Like what? Like the gun is like indestructible.
Yeah, it's crazy. And in all the research that I did leading up to this podcast, I just kept, you know, going, wow, like how is this even how is this even possible? So I guess let's start from where it started. So you're absolutely right. Came out right after the Second World War. It was made by a lieutenant. I think he was a lieutenant general, or he might have been
postmortemly named that, but his name was Mikhail Kalashnikov, right? And I'm probably mispronouncing that, but, you know, go figure, it's bro history. Anyway, so Kalashnikov there, he was a tank operator. He was driving the tanks. He's probably driving a T-34. I don't know that for sure, but let's pretend like he was, because that tank is badass, right?
Most likely was, because yeah. I mean, that the T-34 was the tank that was, I think they manufactured the most. I could be wrong, yeah. But I'm pretty, yeah, they, I'm 95% sure. Tanks.
Yep.
The T-34s were there had to be at least like 25,000, 30,000 put on the field in World War II, probably more.
Yeah, I think there was more. With that being said, so this dude's driving a tank, right? And as far as I understand, like, I wanted to get more juicy details about what happened, but so I'm going to do a little bit of bro history here. I know that he was injured in combat, and I know that I believe that his tank was set on fire. I don't know how. So the bro history version of this is he's in battle with these German Panzer tanks, right? And they hit him, and it lights their fuel on fire, and he has to be drug out of the the tank. I don't actually know that that happened, but that's what I like to envision. Anyway,
that's the folklore.
Yeah, that's the bro history for this one. So dude's a total badass. He's also like a self-taught engineer, like a self-taught mechanical engineer. And that's how he was able to like develop the AK-47. Now AK-47 stands for Automat Kalashnikov 47, and 47 would be the year. And typically speaking, with those number denominations, it's when the assault rifle or when the weapon had came out. Now it was started to be designed in 45, and he was working. I believe it was in Germany. I don't actually have these things completely straightened up, but he's working with this guy, a German dude, and he was pulling basically the best parts of all of the most famous weapons from World War II, right? So he was pulling things from the M1 carbine, and that's the American weapon, by the way. It's like a rifle, single action, semi-automatic. And he also pulled a lot of things from the STG-44, the Sturmgewehr, or assault rifle, 44, from the Germans. And it's actually super close to the Sturmgewehr, the STG 44. Even the look of it, down right down to like, you know, metal barrel, wooden stock. You know, it looks super similar. But he was just basically pulling like the best pieces of all of that and put together a design for it. The Russian or in this case the Soviet Union liked the design, and they put it to field testing in 46. So it sent a bunch of them out there, and it was almost not used because it was super inaccurate, and not like extremely inaccurate, but like just inaccurate enough where they almost didn't want to release it. So this gun fires a really big 7.62 or 7.62 millimeter round. Thing is enormous, and it's slightly tapered at the front, so like it goes from like fat at the back to kind of skinny at the front, which is why you get that like banana looking magazine clip, you know, the curved clip. It's like super iconic.
Yeah,
you know, and that's the reason why, because the bullets are tapered, so they had to put the magazine that way.
What's tapered mean? Tapered, what do you mean by like, the bullets are tapered? So
the back of the bullet, by where the firing pin would strike to like ignite the bullet and, you know, shoot it out the front end. That part is fat, like large, right? Thick. And then the front of the bullet, the casing, is actually thinner than the back. So you can imagine like think about the Eiffel Tower. You know, the Eiffel Tower has a really wide base and then it comes to like a point, right? So that's what tapering is, when you start off wide and you come in closer. So it's tapered like that. So naturally you can't have a straight up and down magazine, because the front of the bullets would like hang low. So they had to make this like little curve, so that when they load I'm forgetting my gun parts here. When it loads into the barrel, right before it's fired, so that it's pointing straight. The bullet, that is. Anyway, I'm getting off topic here. So they almost didn't like it, the Russians.
And it's because the thing was super effective at like 300 meters, like within 300 meters. But like after that, it was the effectiveness just totally dropped off. Now, what they liked about it was, one, it was dirt cheap, like so cheap because they made it out of stamped parts. Now, I don't actually know how to explain what stamped parts are. My guess is that it's just cheaply made metal, right? That also made it lighter. It was so cheap. It was light. It was durable. This thing could go through the most rigorous of conditions. I mean, water, mud, dirt, sand, like you name it. It's going in there and it just fucking works, right? A lot of the reasons why it would just work is because the tolerances between the parts were like looser. I'll try my best to explain this because I'm not like a gun expert, but what that means is like there's a bunch of moving parts inside a gun, obviously, right? A lot of like advanced weapons try to minimize the amount of space between those parts. But because this gun, the AK-47, has so much space in between the parts, it just like lets water through it, lets the sand through it. You just pick it up, shake it off, you know, quick little lubrication, and it's ready to go.
Some quick lube and it's ready to go.
You know, it's funny. I was watching this video. I forget where exactly I found it, but they were saying, you know, in the Middle East, like in Afghanistan, places like that. You know, obviously this is the gun of choice there, and they would ask them. I was like, oh, so like, how often do you clean them? And they would, you know, the Afghanis would look at them like, clean them? Why would you do that? You know, like the most cleaning that they would do is like they take their shoelaces off, tie it in a little knot, dip it in some motor oil, pull it through the barrel, and it's like, okay, cool, clean. Like that's what they would do. And it's like, if you know anything about guns or shooting guns, you know that you know these things need to be cleaned very frequently. They need to be kept up and maintenance, and like otherwise it's gonna jam. Gun's gonna jam. It's not gonna be fun for you, you know. But that just doesn't happen with the AK-47. Not very frequently. And it's a crazy, crazy reliable gun.
Why are there so many AK-47s on the field?
I think there's a lot of reasons. The first reason is because they're dirt cheap. I mentioned that before. I think the current global estimate on how expensive these are is like about $500.
How does that compare to an M4
Or an AR-15? It's just right about the same. But that's on a global scale. We're not talking about, you know, when you zero in on these third world countries, on the Middle East, on Africa, places like that where these guns are being traded the most frequently. And it also doesn't take into account the black market for these guns. So there's actually quite a few of them that are being sold illegally. It's actually the most illegally sold weapon of all time, period. By UN accounts, there's about 75 million of these things running around. That's a lot of weapons. It's a lot of firearms. That makes it I think it's one in five small arms is an AK-47. And that's like that's including every single pistol, rifle, handgun, you name it. One in five of them in the entire planet is an AK-47, which is crazy.
So I guess just give some people some reference right here. What is there about, I don't know the exact number, but there's millions of guns alone in America and in the States. There's more guns than I saw some stats than the actual population.
Yeah. There's definitely more guns than people. Yeah.
So that would mean that now if we take that global, I mean, how many AK-47s are out in the field right now?
So like that we know about, like that the UN would know about is 75 million.
75 million.
Right. But that's that we know about.
There yeah.
So the thing about the AK-47 is while it's a Russian made weapon, so many other countries have plagiarized this gun, and it's such a simply made gun that almost anyone with like some really basic manufacturing skills can make this gun too. So a couple countries, for example, that are doing it, China makes variants, Finland makes them, Bulgaria makes them. a bunch of different, a lot of Soviet bloc countries are making them as well. And they just kind of like slightly changed the name and slight design changes. But for the most part, it's literally the same gun. Even the U.S. makes them. There are some pretty big like manufacturers of the, I think it's the SM4 or SAM4. Which is basically a clone of the AK-47. It's right here in the United States of America. We make them too. Everybody makes them. They're super easy to do. And the fun fact about that was that, like, when this was created in the Soviet Union, like Kalashnikov, you would think that this guy would be loaded, right? But you know, he was in a communist country. There was no patents. There was no
royalties. Ha, ha, ha.
There was no royalties.
Stalin, take your money. Ha, ha, ha. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah. So he didn't make any money out of this, you know?
Yeah, that sucks. But, I mean, at least he...
Browning, Gatling, Colt, like all of these people who made those guns, they're rich. But
yeah, I know.
Kalashnikov? Nah.
That sucks. You have to say it about those Soviet era weapons, the weapons that came out in the Soviet Union. Man, those gotta be the best. I think about it. I really don't have like any type of authority whatsoever to really speak on the subject. However, like when I just like look at the field of work that the Soviets put out in terms of tanks, planes, anti-aircraft, guns, it seems to me that they have made the best weapons over the past 70 decades. I don't know. I you may completely disagree
seven
with
decades,
that, but
70, that would be 700.
70. Yeah. Seven, 70 decades. But over the past 70 years since the Second World War, or during, you know, in the 1930s, I think that's when a T-34 first was fielded, like in what, 1940 or something. But there's something about the Soviet resourcefulness, can I say, would that be the correct word?
Sure.
Like
they're so resourceful
with the equipment that they're using when they're building, when they're crafting, and the designs they use are so simply engineered. I mean, that was one of the major advantage with the T-34 over the German, you know, Tigers and the Panzers during World War II.
Just make
a
fuck ton more of them because it's easy.
Well, the big thing in World War II with like the Tiger and the Panther, like, four or five, I forget which model, but the big complaint from the tank crews was that they were over-engineered. So each tank was built with different parts. Mm-hmm. And the Soviets had this rule where every single tank model or every single tank had to be used, they had to be based on the parts of the other tank. So
really
you'd only
you
have to hold
up.
Yeah, you only have to have one spare part. And there's something about the Soviet, this resourcefulness of how the Soviets built weapons, that's really just amazing.
No, I'd agree with you. But you have to remember that they were in a communist country, right, where everything is state-run. So basically when you have a single party dictating literally every facet of life and definitely every facet of the war machine and in the economic machine, of course – yeah, like, of course you can completely control this. You know, in the U.S., you know, we've got a lot of private companies that are creating our weapons of war, and we have a bidding process by which, you know, we basically choose the cheapest person to do the job. So, like, you know, it's funny that you brought up like part compatibility, right? We talked about the F-30. F-35, right? Lightning in a previous episode, and I told you how Lockheed Martin promised, you know, up to 80% part compatibility across the A, B's, and C's. Of course, that's more like 25% now. But if we were in a communist country where there was no private company engineering this, you would better believe that, you know, it would have to be 80% part compatibility, because that's exactly what they say and that's what goes. Now, I'm glad you brought that up too, because that's another reason why the AK-47 is so ubiquitous, because you can take a gun that was made in 49 and pop off the magazine, the thing that holds the bullets, and slap that onto a brand new, just freshly minted AK-47, and it will still work. You can even take you know, a part, you know, the barrel off of a Bulgarian made, you know, from the 60s assault AK-47 and slap it on an American one and it's going to fit and it's going to work. Part compatibility is huge. And actually, that's a part of the economics of it too. So one of the first reasons that I said why they're so ubiquitous is because they're dirt cheap. And part of the reason why they're dirt cheap is part compatibility. It's actually in Africa and in the Middle East, it's more economic to just cannibalize parts of broken AK-47s to make new AK-47s than it is to buy new AK-47s or to repair existing broken ones.
That's crazy.
Yep.
I guess there's advantages of being a commie, aren't there? Isn't there now?
Yeah, you know, we should really look into that.
No, I get no, definitely, and definitely there's definitely advantages in a military sense of having a state-run economy in terms of just building parts. Like you said, the bidding process with Lockheed Martin promising 80% compatibility and
delivering 25%.
delivering 25%. And yeah, obviously having, when your life is on the line, if you don't hit those metrics, things are going to be a lot different. But yeah, it's super interesting to think how the economic systems shaped the weapons of that era. How
absolutely, yeah.
How having a state-run economy shaped a lot of the, I guess the weapons that we kind of look at as like the most iconic weapons of modern warfare. You know, the AK, T-34, the S, I don't know. I really can't speak to that much of the S-300 in terms of how it was built. That would be an interesting.
Yeah, we should look into
it. Yes, we should look into that definitely. That's Mach 5 rockets, right?
Yep, 5 times the speed of sound. It's ridiculous.
That doesn't even register in my brain.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
Mach 1 doesn't register in my brain, but like Mach 5 just doesn't make sense to me. I know it changes. This is off topic. It changes from like depending on the altitude what Mach is, but like on average, how many miles per hour is that?
I don't know. I think it's like 1200 miles an hour for a Mach per Mach.
Per Mach. So that thing would go around the world. A rocket would go around the world in what?
Hour or two.
Four hours.
Yeah. Couple hours, yeah.
That shit is nuts.
I don't actually know if it has the range to do that because you got to keep in mind to sustain.
Yeah,
like,
obviously,
speed, you have to like have.
Obviously, it doesn't have the range, but right. I'm just talking about just for a reference,
right.
Of how fast that fucker is moving.
Yeah, it's fast.
Yeah,
yeah, it's really.
So
really
here's
fast.
A question.
Yeah, sure.
Here's a question, and I liked how we started off talking about video games.
Yeah,
because I'm interested. I don't really play that many shooter games. Mm-hmm.
You're more of a Candy Crush kind of guy, right?
I'm more of a Candy Crush guy. I'm more of a Yu-Gi-Oh guy.
Weeb.
But a lot of kids, I'm assuming a lot of kids who are into Call of Duty and like the other first-person shooting
PUBG,
games.
Fortnite, Battlefield, yeah.
Does Fortnite use real guns or no?
Fortnite actually, so, you know, they don't name it expressly the AK-47, but they definitely have a model variant that looks just like it and behaves in terms of specifications just like an AK-47. So yeah, and even down to the sound, it sounds like an AK-47. And that's really important. Maybe I'll pull up a clip and throw it in here in post. But it, like one very distinct thing about the AK-47 is the sound that it makes when it fires. The bullets are big and heavy, so they don't fly very fast, right? But they're big, so they make a loud pop. And when they hit with a really heavy kinetic force. So it makes just a very, very specific, distinct sound that's just very ubiquitous. And no matter what video game you play, if you're shooting an AK-47 style assault rifle in it, it's going to sound like that.
So in your opinion, as a gamer, Is that fair to call you a gamer?
Yeah, yeah, it's fair. Yeah.
As a 30-year-old virgin, what would you say? I'm joking. Danny has a girlfriend. As someone who plays video games and who's played different war simulators, what game has the most realistic weapons?
That I'm aware of. I mean, I haven't played every single one, but I got to give that to Battlefield. So what I like so much about Battlefield, and this is just like a large franchise, so that I really liked Battlefield 4 because it was set in the modern era, but it still had a few callback weapons to like some older ones. It definitely had an AK-47. It definitely had AR-15s, things like that. What I like the most about it is the incorporation of bullet physics. So actually taking into account the fact that if you shoot somebody that's like 1,000 meters away from you and you're using a really high powered scope, you're going to have to aim high, you know, because the curvature of the earth is going to pull your bullet down. Right. And gravity is going to pull your bullet down. I don't know how much wind plays into it, but I'd imagine that it has some effect as well. But you have to account for those things. And the weapons are really, really like accurate. Now, what's not accurate about it is like, you know, when you push the reload button, the dude just pops in another magazine and seems to have, you know, you do have a finite number of rounds, but it's just like this dude's carrying like hundreds of rounds of stuff and somehow can still sprint at like, you know, 12 miles an hour. You know, that part's not so real. Yeah, I mean the gunplay in that it's the most realistic that I've experienced, and it makes for an interesting game, you know.
So something that I find super interesting and kind of bizarre and crazy at the same time is the sport of long range shooting.
Oh yeah,
have you ever seen like those long range shooting competitions?
Yep, I've seen them. On YouTube.
They have a team of dorks calculating the bullet ballistics.
Absolutely. Yeah, they have to. They calculate.
They have like
the
their
distance,
own. They have like a caddy. They have like a caddy.
It's called a spotter.
A spotter.
Yeah. And actually, in the military, they have a caddy. And maybe our military guys can back me up on this one, or maybe they can tell me that I'm full of shit. As far as I understand, a sniper, the more experienced of the snipers is actually the spotter. That's the guy who's gonna point out the target, find out exactly how far away it is, measure like the distances, calculate the bullet drop, calculate the wind, and tell you what specs to dial in the gun. And the sniper is literally just the trigger man. He just does exactly what he's told. But you know, in modern warfare, as far as I've been told, you know, the difficult part is actually the spotter's part, not pulling the trigger.
Yeah, I guess when you're talking about targets that are what, like,
Like for example, a Barrett 50 cal,
2,500 yards away,
like a mile away, you know, like this target is a mile away. Can you imagine that? I'm sure we live in New York City. You've definitely walked a mile, right? Think about walking a mile. Now think about hitting a target that far away.
No, I can definitely, I think it's easier for someone from New York. Like I can see down streets and like see iconic buildings, and I pretty much know exactly how far they are from where I'm standing, right, based on
10
like
New
what
York
block
City
I'm
blocks
on.
Or so, you know,
it's 20 New York City blocks is a mile. So I think the MetLife building, which I can see from my apartment, you know, the MetLife building on 40th Street.
Yep.
Or right by Grand Central. That's about 2 miles away from my apartment. So I can honestly visualize shooting that. I guess it's because it's a huge target. It's a building. So I guess
if you can't hit a building from a mile away, then you know there's something wrong with you.
Every once in a while I say something retarded.
All right. So like you look out your window, you see the MetLife building. Okay, now I want you to focus in on one specific window. Right?
Yeah, I know.
And then I want you to imagine that a human being is probably about half the size of that window. And now tell me if you can hit it. You know, like it's just insane. It's just insane. But back to this Kalashnikov 47. So sniping is hard, but firing an AK-47 is not. And this is probably the third reason why I think it's so ubiquitous in the world, is because it is so ridiculously easy to use that you can hand it to somebody and give them like a 2-minute training session. Like, here's the trigger, here's the selector, you know, here's full auto, here's semi-auto, here's safety. Have fun. Like, that's all you need to do, you know?
Go to town, buddy.
I mean, it's so ridiculously easy to use that, I mean, it's ubiquitous in the Middle East for, like, you know, children carry this weapon. And they actually probably more often carry the lighter variant, the AK-74, which shoots a smaller round. It's like a 5.54, I think, which is comparable to the American 5.56 that goes in the AR-15s and the M16s, things like that. But nevertheless, though, these weapons are so incredibly easy to use that children use them, and it's the most used. It's like, you know, it's children approved. It's a fucked up thing to say. I mean, kids are using this weapon right now in places like the Middle East and Africa. Children.
If you're gonna give them a gun, you better give them a beginner's gun.
I mean, if they're firing the 7.62 caliber one, like the AK-47, this is one of the, it's a strong gun. It's not, you know,
I know,
like, it's crazy. But yeah, I mean, they're so easy to use. So, I mean, we talked about in a previous episode about Afghanistan, how, like, we train up a bunch of these guys that basically have no business, being in a military. But you can hand them an AK-47 and be like, here, you know, pull the trigger, point the barrel that way, you'll be good. Some of your bullets might hit, you know. And they're super effective, and they're so easy to use, so cheap, and the part compatibility is there that it is literally a symbol of, like, if you hand, you know, a group of people a dozen or so of these rifles, it immediately gives them the ability to change, like, their lives and the lives of the people around them, you know, for better or for worse, right? This gun is so ubiquitous that, you know, the country of Mozambique adorns the AK-47 on their flag. They have on their flag, it's like all their colors. It's a star, a book, a hoe, and I mean, like, the farming utensil, not like a scandalous woman, and an AK-47 on the flag of Mozambique.
A lot of flags have the AK-47 on it. Like, a lot of militia groups in the Middle East have the AK-47.
This is like a UN-recognized country. This is a UN.
I know.
You know, and that's kind of the thing about it. It's like, you know, as Americans, we grow up, or even as Westerners, we grow up kind of believing that the AK-47 is the bad guy's gun. And this is true even in video games. Like, you know, you play GoldenEye back in the day, they're using the AK-47. You know, like, and it's important to note that, like, the gun isn't bad; it's the people who use it that are bad. But because of the way that it's so ubiquitous and so cheap and so easy, it's like the gun of choice to give to the bad guys. If you want to start a rebel insurrection, if you want to be an ISIS, right? You're not going to go, hey, I want a bunch of AR-15s, because that's expensive as fuck and they don't sell them in your area of the world, you know? But if you need an assault rifle, AK-47, super easy to come by, super easy to maintain, super easy to shoot. And you can raid an entire village with it, you know, and it's crazy. I mean, we've been arming when we armed Afghanistan, when we armed, you know, rebels, we're not giving them our guns. We're buying them AK-47s.
Of course, we're buying them AK-40. We're buying them AKs. We're not going to spend, you know, X amount of dollars on, I guess, whatever the American soldier is holding right now. Like, what is the M4, right? What most military personnel are holding?
It's the M4 carbine, M4 carbine or M4A1, which is just an AR-15 variant. AR-15 standing for Armalite Rifle 15. not assault rifle, by the way. So we know our guns. Tommy Lahren, don't yell at me. Yeah, I mean, like, in certain countries in Africa, you can get an AR-15, excuse me, you can get an AK-47 for about $30 US.
That's fucking crazy.
That's cheaper than the bullets. It's extremely cheap.
That's nuts.
Yep. Thinking about my bank account, which isn't great right now because I'm in between paychecks, but I'm thinking I can buy several AK-47s with that, you know? I can arm a small, you know, military group with that. $30.
You can create a rebel insurgency somewhere.
In some third world country somewhere, yeah.
In third world country with like $10,000.
Oh my God, $10,000, you've got yourself an army.
You got yourself an army and throw in some Toyota trucks. Yep. And
maybe two or three of them, you know,
some two or three Toyota trucks and
some Tacomas.
I don't know whatever guns that they're mounting on those trucks.
Oh, no, those are expensive. Those are higher caliber. I'd assume probably 40 or 50 caliber. You get it.
Whatever they're mounting on those trucks. I've been talking to I talked to some guys in the military, and they were telling me that the Toyota
Tacoma,
Tacoma is fucking better than the Humvee.
You know why? Because they're cheap. Because their parts
are
ubiquitous.
They're better than the Humvee.
Because their parts are ubiquitous. They're faster. They're better on gas. I mean, we should probably make a Toyota Tacoma commercial for Bro History about like how great they are. If you wanna,
there's a mashup on YouTube of It's a Toyota commercial, but it's all just ISIS clips.
Oh God!
Because like ISIS was in like 2016, you know, when they were going on these big convoys, right. There would just be these lines of thousands of these Toyota trucks.
Yeah,
and everyone was like, "Okay, Toyota, why are 5,000 of your trucks with the Islamic State?"
Toyota, the unofficial sponsor of Islamic States of Iraq and Syria.
Toyota. It's just look it up. Just look up the Toyota commercial, the Toyota ISIS commercial, and you're just like, it's funny, but it's also very, very bizarre. How the fuck did they get those trucks and that many of them?
Japan makes a million of them and sells them everywhere. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, you can't blame Toyota. They're just doing their job. You know, like they're just making trucks. They're just making trucks.
They're not signing a contract
with ISIS.
They're not signing with ISIS. Or, you know, they're like, oh, we got a big shipment. Yeah, we're going to sell 5,000 Tacomas to, this place in Syria. No, I don't think they're doing that, but it's just like weird. It's just, I want to know, like, I want to go dive deeper into the process of how all these trucks are getting obtained from, well, I mean, I don't think as much as it was before. I mean, ISIS is kind of ISIS, like the ISIS that was like really, really crazy in Mosul and Syria, for all intents and purposes, has pretty much been eradicated. But however, there's still ISIS brand, the ISIS
brand
in,
guys,
in like
yeah.
the greater Middle East.
Yeah.
They're still ISIS, but there's like, they're not the same ISIS.
You know, the RC Cola of ISIS.
They're still the RC Cola of ISIS still in the Middle East. It's kind of like how, I'm trying to think of a good example. When the Roman Empire fell, this is not a great example, but when the Roman Empire fell, there was like so many different states that started calling themselves Rome again. Like after that, over the next 1500 years, like how many states call themselves Rome, but they weren't really Rome. Yeah. Like they were some fucking country in Germany. I mean, the Ottomans wanted to be Rome, but a Rome with a caliphate. All right. We've been talking a lot. We should probably wrap it up. This was a very educational podcast. So I guess cue the music. Don't get high on your own supply.
And in this case, the supply is AK-47.